A special relationship under strain today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. British police investigating the Manchester bombing have stopped sharing information with the U.S. after leaks to the American press. Britain's prime minister says that's not how the partnership with Washington works.
That partnership is built on trust. And part of that trust is knowing that intelligence can be shared confidently.
Plus, a reporter who's met with Somali militants says they were open to working with the West.
And instead of working with them, the American government just slammed the door in the face.
And we preview the National Puerto Rican Day Parade.
It's like the seminal event of what it is to be Puerto Rican in New York City.
But this year, there's controversy. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We begin once again in Manchester, England, where there was that suspected suicide bombing at the Ariana Grande concert on Monday. 15-year-old Olivia Campbell was one of the victims. Her mother spoke today at a vigil just outside Manchester.
This is such a hard time for us. I had to come. I didn't know what to do. I don't know where to be. I don't know what to do. I just knew something told me I had to come here. I can see Olivia's friends there. As a family, we're united, we're standing strong. I ask her friends, strangers, relatives to do the same. Please stay together. Don't let this be any of us, please. Don't let my daughter be a victim.
As Britons unite in their grief, the investigation into the bombing has caused a temporary rift between Britain and the United States. All this week, British officials had been sharing intelligence with their U.S. counterparts, but some of that information ended up being leaked to and published by some American news outlets, and British Prime Minister Theresa May was upset.
We have a special relationship with the USA. It is our deepest defense and security partnership that we have. Of course, that partnership is built on trust, and part of that trust is knowing that intelligence can be shared confidently.
Earlier today, the British government announced it would stop sharing intel on the Manchester attacks with the U.S., but after U.S. assurances, that sharing looks set to resume. For his part, President Donald Trump has promised an inquiry into the leaks and prosecutions if necessary. My colleague, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, has been following events. What has been leaked so far, Jonathan?
Well, a whole litany of things that have been leaked. This is the extraordinary thing. The casualty figures, the attack method, the name of the suicide bomber himself, the news of the arrest of his brother, and of course, most extraordinary, the actual crime scene pictures of the device and the bag in which it's believed it was carried, which were leaked to the New York Times yesterday. And what's unusual, I think, about this, you know, it's just not a single leak. It seems to be a whole pattern of leaks to different American news networks or news organizations.
Yeah, and it's that kind of tail end of these leaks going to these media outlets here in the U.S. It's also been a source of big anger, incandescent anger, I heard from one report.
Indeed. I think this is hugely damaging. Certainly the police and those closest to the investigation feel that this is wholly inappropriate and actually detrimental to their efforts. I think particularly the early release of the name of the bomber. Because obviously the concern now is that there's a belief that there was a network involved. Indeed, the bomb maker himself may still be at large. And so there is a great concern and a great urgency to push on with things to forestall the possibility of any second attack.
How damaging are these leaks likely to be?
It obviously has a damage in the relationship between the US and Britain. Both President Trump and the Prime Minister, Mrs. May, have taken pains to stress that they, you know, they want to get to the bottom of this. The President has made that very clear. But at the moment, it's a slightly tense relationship. Mr. Trump, shall we say, is an unusual American president. He's not the kind of American president that British governments are perhaps used to dealing with. And so this adds another layer of uncertainty. I should say also that it was interesting that President Trump chose to, in his response, to set these leaks in a wider pattern of leaks from the American intelligence services. Clearly, his administration is, if you like, the target of some of those leaks. So it is all a slightly unusual picture, and one wonders who was leaking this material and why.
That was my BBC colleague Jonathan Marcus there. It's one thing for an official from law enforcement or an intelligence agency to leak material. It's another for journalists to decide to publish. In this case, that decision fell to the New York Times. We asked the Times to comment, and they sent us this statement. The images and information presented were neither graphic nor disrespectful of victims and are consistent with the common line of reporting on weapons used in horrific crimes, as the Times and other media outlets have done following terrorist acts around the world. And it continues, our mission is to cover news and inform our readers. We have strict guidelines on how and in what ways we cover sensitive stories. Our coverage of Monday's heinous attack has been both comprehensive and responsible. So that leads to the question, when should a news outlet publish this kind of material? Andrew Seaman is the chair of the Ethics Committee of the Society of Professional Journalists. So the Times statement focuses on the issues of taste and respect for the victims. How does that mesh with your guidelines on crime scene images?
I think it, you know, I've seen the images and I think that, you know, their selection was consistent with what we've seen elsewhere. It obviously doesn't really show graphic images. I think it shows some smears of blood and obviously the weapons used. So it's not something that you wouldn't expect to see after sort of a horrific event. Obviously, in the aftermath of the bombing, there were pictures of injured, wounded people. So sometimes, you know, that could be more graphic. You know, what I think is obviously a big concern here, too, is the nature of sort of the security aspect of this. You know, does this impact national security? And I'm sure that the New York Times sort of takes that into account.
Well, I mean, there is some concern, especially in the UK, that publication of this material could compromise the investigation of a very serious crime. What do your ethical guidelines say about that?
Traditionally, what news organizations do is they usually go to security officials in the United States with sensitive information to say, you know, does this actually, you know, harm our efforts or put the U.S. security at risk? And I would assume that in this case, the New York Times would do that because it is such standard practice. You know, their statement doesn't address that, but typically that's what happens. One of the society's core tenets of its code of ethics is minimize harm. And we like to think of that holistically. So part of that is to think, you know, how does this harm people directly, but also in a larger sense? So in this case, it would be, you know, does this put sort of the nation's security at risk?
The New York Times story included technical details on the bomb and detonator. Couldn't that impact the minds and behavior of the bomber's co-conspirators, especially the bomb maker? I mean, it could even give the bomb maker a sense of what the authorities have not discovered, couldn't it?
Possibly, but, you know, with something like that, it would also be something to talk about with your sources, because this is not, you know, they're not general assignment reporters typically who are finding this thing, these things out. These are reporters who are working, you know, diligently with their sources that they've cultivated and gotten to know over the years. So, you know, possibly, but again, that's something that you would talk to officials about.
Do you ever worry that, you know, details on bombings like this that make it into newspapers are so tantalizing that they can be seen to drive profits?
I think so. You know, I think there's a lot of people who view most news organizations and media organizations in that light, that most of their stories are driven that way. And I think we've maybe seen some movement toward that, especially with cable news. But, you know, I think most journalists, when they go to work and, you know, they're showing up at meetings and they're working on stories, they're not necessarily thinking about that. I think most of them are very much thinking of, you know, getting the truth out there and getting good information to the public.
Andrew Seaman, he's the chair of the Ethics Committee of the Society of Professional Journalists. Sadly, Monday's attack was not a new experience for Manchester. Since the 1970s, the city's seen a number of bombings. Perhaps the most infamous happened about 21 years ago. It was a June morning in 1996. The Provisional Irish Republican Army, the IRA, detonated a massive truck bomb in the center of Manchester.
It's hard to overestimate just how huge this bomb was. When you look at the images of it, it's, you know, leaves an enormous mushroom cloud.
Adam Taylor is with the Washington Post. He's been comparing this week's bombing in Manchester with the one in 96.
The aftermath was really devastating for the city, and it's something a lot of Mancunians remember very well and has really shaped their city.
Yeah, and strangely, nobody was killed in that massive truck bomb, were they?
No, and this is partly down to the IRA's tactics. They actually gave a warning call about an hour beforehand. And they also didn't really sort of go for very, very soft targets. You know, their main thing was really trying to inflict commercial damage on the United Kingdom and trying to make it just too expensive for the United Kingdom to keep control of Northern Ireland. The ideological attacks of someone like the Islamic State, you know, it's very different, and it's very much aimed at inflicting harm upon sort of the idea of the West, which was, you know, never anything that the IRA was really doing.
Yeah, I think we should say that we know one of these bombs was the IRA, and we are following the investigation leads that tell us this week's bombing was motivated probably by Islamist ideology. So let's talk about the reactions in the city to both of these events. In the immediate aftermath of the attack this week, we saw the Manchester community coming together, cabbies offered free rides. There's even a story about the homeless helping to treat the wounded. How does that compare to the public's response in 1996?
You definitely saw something quite similar. I think a lot of people would argue it's kind of a Mancunian way of, you know, sort of keeping on and keeping going on. At the same time, the Irish community in Manchester, a very large Irish community, a very historically important Irish community, did fall under suspicion because of attacks in Manchester, not just in 1986, but also ones before then and going back to the 1970s.
Yeah, elaborate on that suspicion, what those Irish living in Manchester felt after that bombing in 96.
When you look back at accounts of the time, and you know, there's been some good oral histories, you hear things about like the Irish Community Centre in Manchester was getting hundreds of phone calls from angry people, you know, some just criticizing, some threatening. And I read one account which was talking about an Irish nurse, you know, literally helping people, but she was told by colleagues to go back home.
Well, we've heard from Muslim leaders in Manchester that there have been a number of Islamophobic incidents in the city since Monday's attack, so there are some similarities there too.
Yes, definitely, and it should be noted that there's a pretty big and you know, pretty integral Muslim community in Manchester, particularly in the south side of the city. There's you know, a lot of mosques and a lot of Muslims who are very much part of the community and, you know, are not supportive of terror attacks in any way. So it puts them in an awkward position and an unfortunate position.
I mean, it's an interesting comparison. Same city, two bombings more than 20 years apart, different motivations, similar reactions. Ultimately, what conclusion did you come to in comparing these two events?
There's no clear conclusion. I mean, it's just very fascinating to see how things have changed over these years. You know, one of the things I found really striking actually when I was reading some of sort of the Irish diaspora papers just before this interview, they were actually talking sort of supportively of the Muslim community and saying, you know, well, we went through this in 1996. You know, we know that just because you're part of a ethnic or religious group doesn't mean you condone the work of terrorists or political extremists or whatever you want to say. And I think it's quite interesting to see that. Manchester is a city with like a lot of spirit, and it really was able to sort of be reborn after the 1996 attack. I can't see any reason that it wouldn't still be the incredible city it is today after this recent attack.
Adam Taylor with The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, how an African-American Mennonite from Indiana became a Yoruba priest in Puerto Rico. That means you must be with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. June 11th will be a big day for Puerto Ricans. If you're on the island, that's when the territory will vote on whether to become a state or an independent nation. If you're in New York, you know the National Puerto Rican Day Parade is happening that same day. The parade is embroiled in controversy, kind of like the island itself right now. Congress has started hearings on how to handle the island's oversized debt crisis, and students have been out on the streets of San Juan to protest conditions like the lack of clean water. The world's Maria Muir Marielle has been following all of this. Let's start close to home, Maria. What's going on with this important date on the calendar for Puerto Ricans, the National Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York?
So last week, the parade started getting in the headlines because they lost a big sponsor, Goya Foods, which is the largest Hispanic-owned food company in the U.S. It's a Puerto Rican company. Lots of people in our audience probably look for this brand in their supermarkets so they can make their food from back home. And Goya decided last week to pull out of the parade. And they've been a sponsor for 60 years since the beginning.
I mean, it's understandable that people would have a lot of strong feelings about that. It's a beloved brand of Latin food, as you said, that's been part of life since childhood for a lot of Latinos. But why is losing one sponsor so controversial?
Initially, they'd lost the one sponsor. But since then, a lot of other names have pulled out. Like JetBlue has pulled out, the New York Yankees, the New York Daily News is pulled out from the parade. And what's causing a lot of controversy seems to be that the parade this year is honoring Oscar Lopez Rivera.
Right. And he's the former political prisoner who got his sentence commuted by Obama earlier this year, one of Obama's last acts in office, right?
Right before he left office, yeah. So Lopez Rivera was associated with a series of bombings in New York City in the 70s and 80s. He was part of this radical militarist group, a nationalist group that was fighting for the independence of Puerto Rico, which, as we know, is a U.S. territory. There are people coming out saying that we shouldn't be honoring this person and calling him a terrorist. So I talked to Julio Varela from the NPR show Latino USA. He could explain a little bit more of the significance of this parade.
The thing about the parade, it's like the seminal event of what it is to be Puerto Rican in New York City. And it has this sort of interesting tension between how Puerto Ricans on the island view the parade to how Puerto Ricans in the diaspora view the parade. And there's always been that tension.
Yeah. So, Maria, how do these different groups on the island and the Puerto Ricans in New York and in the diaspora view this parade?
I'm going to generalize here, but typically the parade on the mainland is seen as a fun way to celebrate your heritage, and it's a day of pride for Puerto Ricans in the New York area. And on the island, especially this year with the debt crisis and there's a lack of potable water in Puerto Rico, it seems like maybe a distraction. And Marco, the parade is on the same day as a plebiscite, a vote on the island on whether Puerto Rico will become a state or an independent nation.
I mean, that is a huge deal.
Yeah. And if Puerto Rico became the 51st state, they'd be able to file for bankruptcy. The government, the federal government, would be able to fund federal programs in Puerto Rico. And the tally for that would be in the billions.
Yeah, like everything you just said is seriously consequential stuff for the island. Meanwhile, Puerto Ricans here in the States are talking about a parade.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember also, Marco, this has been a question for a long time. I mean, Puerto Rico has been a U.S. territory for as long as I've been alive. So this is not necessarily a new debate, but there is criticism of the fact that the parade does not use its huge platform to discuss politics.
You're literally shutting down Manhattan on a Sunday in the summer. And here's an opportunity where people that complain that no one talks about Puerto Rico, you know, it's never breaking news. So when you have an opportunity where you become the focus of something, the community's out there, and you're not using it to your advantage to inform the rest of the country?
Well, it also seems that no matter what this year, there's going to be, already is, a heightened political tone at the parade.
Definitely.
The World's Maria Muriel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marco.
Puerto Rico is where Otura Moon started a new life. He was born Mark Underwood, an African-American raised in a Mennonite family.
I grew up in a little small town. It's Goshen, Indiana. It's maybe 15,000 people when I was there. I went to a high school that was maybe 1,200 students. There were 8 black students in the high school, including my sister. So it was just a really rough place to grow up. And I was used to being an outsider for sure.
But when he moved to Puerto Rico in 1999, Underwood's life was transformed. He went from being an outsider in Goshen to being an insider in a place he'd never been before. And not just any insider, he got deep into a religion called Yoruba. It's a belief system passed down through slaves from Nigeria. Underwood decided to quit the Mennonite faith and become an ordained Yoruba priest. He stopped observing God and began praying to the Orishas, multiple deities, and he changed his name to Otura Moon. But through it all, one thing has remained constant in his life, music. Algo para ti, algo para mí, divino, verdad que sí. This track is from Otura Moon's musical project Ife. It's sacred and secular, traditional and modern, and the perfect space for Otura Moon to experiment.
When I was thinking about how to put together the sound for Ife, I knew that I wanted to have the music be able to have space for improvisation. And I really liked the music of Cuban rumba, and I figured that the nuts and bolts of that musical conversation could be used to sort of make something modern. There's also the music of Biorisha, which is through the cult Anya, and that's three bata drummers that are playing together along with a singer to sort of make this music that interfaces with the Orishas.
So there's a lot of call and response in many of the songs that goes back to the super rootsy Afro-Cuban thing that's going on. How much manipulation do you do with the electronics?
I mean, you could say the entire thing is manipulated because what you're hearing on the record is played live. There's no programming on the record.
It's a really surprising sound because at first it feels like an Alan Lomax field recording, and then all this modern stuff starts happening, and there are parts of it that are super danceable. Was that the intent? Yeah. Did you want to make a dance album, basically?
I didn't necessarily want to make a dance album, but the idea of singing and dance in sort of in adoration to the Orishas or in any kind of spiritual practice when it deals with music on an African end are sort of inseparable. You wouldn't have prayer without song and without dance.
Mucho trabajo, Rihanna me dijo, dame cuchillo, vuelvo repito, dame cuchillo, pa'lante yo pico, óyeme tipo, como te digo, yo no me quito, negro y verde, oh, arere, sé lo que quiero.
Praise on the dance floor, trip-hop style, a lot of stuff going on here. That was Otura Moon talking about his music project, Ife.
Clavo martillo, llave macho, rastrillo. Tres clavo martillo, ese nene, Dios mío. Tres clavo martillo, que me falta.
I'm Marco Werman. This Ugandan woman was recruited for a job in the Middle East. She went to Kuwait expecting to be a teacher.
You get excited because you're told they'll give you food, they'll give you shelter, get the money.
Instead, she wound up a slave cleaning toilets. Now she's trying to rebuild her life. Her story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. All this week, we've been bringing you stories about modern-day slavery and the road out of it. It's part of our Across Women's Lives project. One big part of this complicated human puzzle is the demand for cheap, imported labor. According to the UN, more than 240 million people have left their home countries in search of various opportunities. For women, that often means jobs in childcare and the service industry. But what they sign up for is often not what they get. Jasmine Garst has our story, which begins with a description of a disturbing video.
In the video, an anguished Ugandan girl in a blue headscarf asks that her parents be contacted. She says she's sick and not allowed to come back home. No one knows where the video was shot. It's believed to be from inside an Arab country, and it sparked outrage in Uganda. But no one should have been surprised. When you think of slavery, you might think about the trade from Africa and America. But the business of slaves being sent to the Middle East is ancient, and right now, business is booming. Uganda has one of the youngest populations in the world. Nearly 80% of the country is under 30, and most are unemployed. Prudence Ndaula did have a job as a teacher in Masaka, a town in central Uganda that the equator runs through. She made about $160 a month, which is good by Ugandan standards. Enough to pay rent, send her son to school, and Prudence even had a maid. Still, when she was offered a job teaching in Kuwait, making twice as much, she was thrilled.
I was so excited. I thought when I go there, maybe get the money, I'll be able to support my boy.
She'd been told by a friend of her brother that it was a great opportunity.
You get excited because you're told they'll give you food, they'll give you shelter.
Most of the girls who are recruited in Uganda are mostly recruited by their friends and relatives, someone you know.
That's Mayambala Wafrika. He's an activist for the rights of Ugandan workers abroad. He says this is usually how it goes. A friend of an extended family member, a buddy of an acquaintance will hit you up on social media. When Prudence arrived in Kuwait, things unraveled quickly. The family who sponsored her took her passport and told her there was no teaching job. Start cleaning. Prudence says at that moment, it dawned on her. She'd gone from being a teacher to a servant in a foreign country against her will.
And then I'm like, oh my goodness, I also had a housemaid back home, and now here am I working in someone's house.
Still, she stuck it out for a few months. But the hours were brutal. The family screamed at her, and other employees got beaten. She told her employers she wanted to leave.
And they're like, no, you're not supposed to go, you're supposed to finish the contract. Of which they're talking of the contract you've not even signed.
Typically, a Kuwaiti family pays a recruitment agency as much as $4,000 for an African maid for a 2-year contract. And remember that guy, her brother's friend back in Uganda, who had told them about this great job opportunity? He got a cut of that. He was a middleman. And guys like him can make as much as $500 per girl. Everyone profited handsomely, except for Prudence.
Yeah, they paid me. They paid me, but the money I expected wasn't the money I was getting.
She actually made less than what she made back home, and she was stuck. There isn't even an embassy in Kuwait for Ugandans to get help.
They get these girls, pay them a small amount of money, but still treat them in the same gruesome ways that slaves were treated.
Mayambala Wafrika, the labor rights activist, says it's modern-day slavery.
They are deceived, and the only resort that they have is to work as a housemaid.
He says the recruitment agencies judge the girls the same way slave traders would over a century ago.
Someone comes, looks at you, checks your height, your weight, your skin color, decides whether you're worth the amount of money is going to be paying for you.
Ugandan women are also coveted because, unlike women in some sub-Saharan countries, they speak English. Prudence's luck changed one day when the family she worked with invited some friends for dinner. Those friends brought their own maid, also a Ugandan woman. Prudence told her about the abuse. The woman encouraged her to get out. And she did. One morning, while the family slept, Prudence quietly left the house. Her odyssey was far from over. As soon as she walked out that door, her employment visa was canceled. Prudence turned herself into the police. She spent 3 weeks in jail waiting to get deported. And she was lucky. Some girls spend months there. An acquaintance managed to get her passport back from her furious boss, which is usually not how it goes. The Ugandan embassy in Saudi often has to intervene. And the Ugandan government has had to express its outrage time and again. The response from Middle Eastern governments is usually indifference. There is a high demand for unskilled labor, and there's so many countries willing to provide it.
The day I come back, it was exciting. Yeah, it was exciting to be home because most people come back when they are sick.
Prudence was able to come back to Uganda. She's a teacher now. She has a few side gigs. She makes a decent living. But the economy in Uganda took a dip in the last year. Everyone's pocket is a little tighter around here. And Prudence says she might try her luck in the Middle East again. But this time, she'd be so much more cautious.
I can't say I will not go back. If they change the system that is there, then I'll be free to go back.
And that's exactly what Mayambala Wafrika wants. Full protection for Ugandans working overseas. And until then, at least a ban on domestic workers leaving Uganda for the Middle East. That's unlikely, though. The Ugandan government has tried such a ban in the past, but without success. This is a poor country. A lot of people really rely on the money their relatives send back home. But Mayambala says if the Ugandan government doesn't protect its girls, who will? For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst in Kampala, Uganda.
Our Across Women's Lives team has been gathering stories from all over Uganda. You can check out interview extras and behind-the-scenes looks on our Women's Lives Instagram. Just look for Women's Lives on Instagram. Our series on trafficking continues tomorrow. From Uganda, we move to the U.S.-Mexico border and hear the story of a teenage girl who was trafficked in the 1950s.
Francisca got her big break one day when she was 16 while she was working. An older woman approached her and said, "We're looking for waitresses right on the border with Texas, a tiny town called Villacuña, at a restaurant called La Perla, the Pearl." Francisca packed up and headed there to her new job waiting tables. It was about a day's travel. But when she finally got to this town, well, there wasn't a restaurant. She says there weren't even streets, really. The Pearl was a house in the dusty middle of nowhere. It was a brothel.
A brothel exclusively for the U.S. military. We'll have the rest of that story tomorrow, right here on The World. It hasn't happened since the infamous Black Hawk Down battle in 1993. Last month, a U.S. soldier was shot and killed fighting in Somalia. Reports indicate the Navy SEAL was serving right alongside his Somali counterparts, not advising from the operating base, as they battled al-Shabaab militants. New York Times correspondent Jeffrey Gettleman has covered Somalia for years. He even managed to get an interview with Shabaab commanders. Gettleman writes about it in his new memoir, Love Africa. We talked about that new book, but I began by asking him what U.S. Navy SEALs are doing so close to the combat zone in Somalia.
There are hundreds of troops crawling around different parts of Somalia, and the official explanation of what they're doing is that they are advising and assisting Somali forces in their battle against Islamic terrorists. But many of us suspect this is not simply just advice and assistance, that American troops are fighting toe-to-toe with Shabaab militants. And the fact that a Navy SEAL was just killed in combat in a spray of bullets fired at a vehicle pretty much confirms what we had always suspected.
Did this increase in U.S. military in Somalia, did this start under Obama? I mean, and how much has the Trump White House increased the numbers?
U.S. policy towards Somalia hasn't changed president to president. In the last couple of years, we've seen this steady buildup of American special forces in Somalia. And the idea is they are trying to help root out the Shabaab terrorist network. But it's still there. There are bombs going off all the time. Shabaab continue to terrorize people across the country. And they have some local support, which is something that everybody has to reckon with. There are people in Somalia who believe the Shabaab are less corrupt, more efficient, and more trustworthy than their own officials.
Do you have any specific stories about the U.S. troops and what they're doing there?
Well, they're trying to increase the capacity of the Somali forces to be able to protect their own country. But the problem is Somalia hasn't had a functioning central government for more than 25 years. And it's basically a country without a state. It's a space on the map that's shaped like Somalia, but there's no meaningful state there. And the fear is that Somalia could become a launching pad for terrorist groups because it remains chaotic and violent. And so the U.S. government is very interested in what's happening on the ground in these dusty little villages and large forgotten wastes across the Somali desert because it's a perfect place for people to hide out. Mm. And there's a history of that. Two American embassies were blown up in 1998 in East Africa by al-Qaeda terrorists. So the fear is if you don't put a lot of pressure on Somalia, there could be opportunities for terrorists to strike again at American targets.
Jeff, back to this idea that many Somalis support al-Shabaab. You've been in a lot of places where al-Qaeda offshoots have set up shop, Pakistan, Iraq, Somalia, and yet they keep on going despite this global war on terror. What have you learned over the years about why they continue to thrive? Like what sort of core does their message continue to strike in 2017?
Part of it has to do with state failure, that it's very hard to root out these terrorist groups when you have no alternative. And there's just a vacuum of authority. And people are gravitating for some type of leadership and some type of structure. And the first outfit that arrives to bring a little of that discipline gets some popular support automatically. There's also a kind of pattern of U.S. mistakes. I write about in the book how in 2006, when this Islamic group came to power in Somalia, they were open-minded about working with the American government. I met some of the leaders of the Shabaab. They seemed to truly think that there was a way they could work with the West and bring stability to Somalia. And instead of working with them, the American government just slammed the door in the face. And they just started supporting the, other forces in the region to push these Islamists out. And that created this cycle of chaos and famine, pirates on the high seas. It put Somalia in a deeper tailspin.
You know, in your book, Love Africa, you dig in almost tangentially to a lot of these stories because the book is very personal. But there's one passage about your first job in journalism. It's down in Florida, St. Petersburg. And you write, "In my first year from a town of 7,000, I covered a father and son who nearly killed each other over a meatball, a rodeo rider who punched out a judge, rapes, drownings, fatal car wrecks and murders, et cetera, and people say Africa is violent." It sounds like you've considered these two places over the years. What occurs to you when you compare Africa and small-town USA?
I kind of feel like I'm a sort of lifetime police reporter wherever I am, whether it's in central Florida in a little town or in a place like Mogadishu, Somalia, or Iraq. I came to Africa as a young guy when I was 18 years old and was just blown away by the warmth and the welcome and the friendliness and just the vibe that I got walking down the streets of Nairobi or traveling overland to, through rural Tanzania and just feeling connected to people and being around a part of the world where people had so much less than anything I had ever experienced. Yet there was a real connection and spirit between them. Like, for instance, I wrote about the Westgate Mall attack in Kenya,
right,
where some Shabaab terrorists came into a mall in Kenya in 2013 and gunned down dozens of innocent people that were just shopping in the mall. But even at that moment, there was this beautiful thing that happened where all these off-duty police officers who are often accused of corruption and acting like thugs ran into the mall and started trying to fight these terrorists with their little pistols and, bad equipment because the Kenyan military and police were nowhere to be found. And these guys saved hundreds of lives. And if it wasn't for their courage, which I would never think I'd be the one saying, these Kenyan police were courageous, there would have been so many more people killed. And they didn't get bonuses or any official recognition. They did this because they cared and they wanted to help defenseless people.
New York Times correspondent Jeffrey Gettleman's new book is called Love Africa, A Memoir of Romance, War, and Survival. Good to speak with you, Jeffrey. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
One last note before the break. It's about a story we're working on for tomorrow's show about a teenager in El Salvador who chose not to join a gang. But now gang members say they'll kill him. He's applied for asylum in the U.S., but the process takes too long, so he's in hiding.
He's been inside my apartment for 1 year now. He only goes out onto the patio. He doesn't have any freedom.
What the U.S. can and can't do for Central American kids under threat. That's tomorrow. Back to our top story today. Salman Abedi is the man alleged to have carried out Monday's attack in Manchester. The 22-year-old was born in the city to Libyan parents, and investigators are reportedly trying to connect any dots they can find that link Abedi back to Libya. It's all got some in Manchester scared. The city and its suburbs are home to a fair number of Libyan immigrants. My BBC colleague Manveen Rana has been speaking with some of them.
In the suburbs of Didsbury and nearby Rosham, nobody seems to have known Salman Abedi, and the Libyan community are keen to explain that his actions certainly didn't represent them.
We are deeply shocked. Who would go out there and hurt kids? And we just condemn in strong terms all what has happened. It is and will never be in my name.
If you are making trouble, so you should leave this country. Even yesterday when I go with my kids to garden, I'm scaring.
Do you worry that people here in Manchester will now think that the Libyan community, will look on them differently?
Yeah, I feel like a shame on the whole Libyan community, yes. That's a very big shame.
I was incredibly shocked that the guy was Libyan, and it made me sad and sick to my stomach.
This young Libyan says he's lived in Manchester all his life. He asked not to be named because he feared the reaction from within the community, but, he says, he knew the bomber, Salman Abedi.
I've seen him a few times in the gym, and he used to be in and around the Woolley Range, Old Trafford area. So, you know, all Libyans here are aware of each other. We're like a closer community.
What was he like?
To me as a person, he was incredibly polite. I mean, like, I didn't see this coming. I know people always say this of, like, we never saw it coming, we never knew it was them, we never suspected them, but this is genuinely how everybody felt. He wasn't a type of kid that stood out in any way. He wasn't aggressive, he was never violent in any way, he never showed those tendencies. I think he was incredibly brainwashed or made to feel desensitized towards the suffering of the people he was going to carry the tax against. You know, he just maybe got into the mindset of seeing, you know, the British public as an enemy just because he has grievances towards the British establishment, in a sense, or because of their foreign policy.
So in your age group, in the Libyan community here in Manchester, are you hearing a lot of people having frustrations like that? I mean, do you think it is fueling some extremism?
With all due respect, you'd have to be stupid to not realise that, you know, certain foreign policies are fueling extremism. You have to be either living under a rock or just in complete and utter denial or just delusional, in a sense.
A young Manchester resident of Libyan descent, ending that report by the BBC's Manveen Rana. Finally today, one of the great cycling races, the Tour of Italy, the Giro d'Italia, concludes its 100th edition on Sunday in Milan. Riders race across the island of Sicily, over to the mainland, and straight up from the heel of Italy's boot to the top of it. 80 years ago, an Italian won the race. His name was Gino Bartali. He won the Giro two other times. Bartali also won the Tour de France twice. Jonathan Friedman is an avid cyclist who knows the Gino Bartali story well, especially the part about how Bartali risks his own life during the Nazi occupation to save the lives of hundreds of Italian Jews from the Nazis.
You know, there's a famous story where he smuggled documents in the frame of his bike, thinking that if he would be stopped, he would tell them that nobody should touch his bike because it was set up perfectly for racing and shouldn't be tinkered with. So he was able to use his training to move around the country in ways that others couldn't, because movement was generally restricted and under suspicion.
That was pretty clever, taking documents and sticking them in the hollow tubes of his bicycle frame. How many Italian Jews was he able to assist?
Well, the numbers come out to be about 800. But, you know, it was also taking documents to Assisi. Assisi had a printer there who would print the documents, and then he would courier them back and forth. I think there's one story where he was under suspicion. I mean, he did get stopped and sent to a notorious prison where one of the fascist leaders, who was famous for torturing, got him under his thumb. And in the end, I think one of the soldiers who knew him intervened, and he was able to get out of jail after a couple of days. But it certainly was a very scary moment and showed how dangerous it was what he was undertaking.
What drove him to do this risky work?
My personal feeling from reading his story is that all his life he was an underdog, you know, coming from Tuscany, where it wasn't really the hotbed of cycling. So I think he identified with outsiders. Another factor certainly was he just had a very strong sense of right and wrong. And then when it came to what he had done, he just kind of swept it under the rug and didn't make a big deal about it. So I think definitely his humility shines through. And I think he had also said that he didn't want to overshadow others that had done an equal amount. So I was in Italy last week riding in his honor. And one of the things that I was really happy to do was we spent some time in Assisi, and we went into a church where they hid Jews like in a subterranean cellar. And I personally went down just to have a look. So I think he felt that it wasn't just him, and if he spoke about it, you know, he would get the glory and others would be forgotten.
But Gino Bartali's story has kind of consumed you. I mean, can you explain why Gino Bartali's story has become such a part of your own life?
Well, that's been a bit of a shock to me. You know, if I were to psychoanalyze myself, I mean, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors from Hungary. And so when I first heard the story, just by chance, I was visiting an Italian barbershop. And I knew the barber for many years. He was from the old country, and he introduced me to a producer of a documentary called My Italian Secret. The story just really, really hit me. It's the romance of cycling. It's the heroism. It's the fact that he was a famous sports figure. And I just thought, wow, what an amazing story. And I asked around, and nobody seemed to know it. And I just thought, you know, this is something I can do to honor his memory. Let me do something small. I rode in a charity ride, and it got front page coverage in the newspaper Carriera in Florence. And I said, wow, this really resonated with people. And so I pressed on, and I brought the idea to a professional Israeli cycling team called Israel Cycling Academy. And that's when it really grew into something much more meaningful, because we rode in Italy. But I feel that it is important to shine a spotlight on heroism, because it's relevant to our own development as people, and for our kids to see that people risk their lives in a terrible time.
I got to say, chain-smoking, Chianti-loving, 34-year-old cycling legend just seems like it's made for the Hollywood treatment. When is that going
to
happen?
Oh, I'd love to see it. And, you know, if there's anything for my own personal amusement that, you know, that would be fun for me, is to just be one of the cycling extras in that kind of film. So it's a real comeback underdog story with heroism set against the backdrop of, you know, of the war. So I think from that perspective, it would make a fascinating film.
That's Jonathan Friedman in New York telling us about Italian cycling hero Gino Bartoli. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a short film on Gino Bartoli. Just visit The World on Facebook, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.